probably in terms of the transitions, no-till became more common when John Deere introduced the 750 no-till drill and Roundup. Mm-hmm. So those couple of things really blossomed with people more interested in no-till. I think somewhere around the year 2000 is when cover crops became more interesting and more involved, and most people realized that, yeah, no-till by itself, and we're talking here mainly corn soybean rotation with some wheat once in a while, mm-hmm. that it could be a lot better if we added cover crops.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. A robust return on your sorghum investment is not just a dream. Learn more at doubleteamsorghum.com. KWS Hybrid Rye, seeding the future since 1856.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. Today, I'm excited to have on Mr. Randall Reeder, who is the program coordinator of the annual Conservation Tillage and Technology Conference and the executive director of the Ohio No-Till Council. And probably more so where I know Mr. Reeder from is he was a former, he is a former extension ag engineer at the Ohio State University, where he was at for 32 years. Where Randall worked on a lot of research, specifically looking at soil compaction and tillage systems. So a lot of what I go to is all my go-to engineers have basically been the Ohio State engineer crew. And so, you know, I think I've probably looked at tons of data sets that you were involved in that have been presented by the ag engineers at Ohio State. And so, Randall, I'm so excited to have you on today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be on there at the other OSU.
Yeah, I have to make sure I put the in front of OSU with you, but
I should reverse that and say we're the other OSU here in Columbus, Ohio.
So tell us a little bit about how you ended up being the program coordinator as a retired extension specialist.
Well, the short answer is I was already doing that as part of my work. And when I retired in 2011, nobody wanted to step up and take it over. We make a little bit of money. I probably make minimum wage on what I do as a meeting planner, but it keeps me involved. That's the important thing, Brian.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us, before we get really heavy, tell us a little bit about the meeting. You know, when did it start and how did it come about and how has it transitioned over the years?
Well, what's now the Conservation Tillage and Technology Conference began as a one-day ridge-till event. Another extension person was in charge of that in probably 1982. And when he retired about 4 years later, he just told me I was going to take over. So I did. And so it remained ridge till until about 1990. And we added no till. And about that same time, I was doing research on tillage that was mainly ridge till, chisel plow compared to moldboard plowing on drained and undrained. And at that same time, we added no-till into that research. So everything kind of blended together. And we've moved a couple of times. Now we're at an excellent facility at Ohio Northern University where we meet during their spring break. So we've got the whole facilities that we need. And we've had just over 1,000 people. Now we're pretty much around 700 to 800 people at that two-day conference. We have concurrent sessions, so there's a lot of different topics from cover crops and no-till to also another one on fertility management. A lot of that is manure management, water quality, different subject areas, and a lot of crop consultants come to that. So it's a great conference. It's been going on every year.
So I want to, just because of my own interest, and since I'm the host, I get to stick with my own interest as much as I want to. I do, you know, I plan meetings. I plan a couple two-day events. Mine's a lot smaller. How do you keep the subject matter interesting so that you're continuously important? Because right now the competition for people's attention and the money and time investment in going to a meeting. It seems like a constant challenge for me to keep something where I'm proud of presenting something new and innovative.
Well, that's true. We've kept our costs down. So believe it or not, 2 days, it's only $100 registration. And I realize that for most people, the cost of their 2 days away from their normal work adds up to quite a bit more than that. We have university presenters. We have outstanding farmers, farmer panels. You probably know are some of the most popular parts of a program. We bring in typically university people from 7 or 8 different universities, mostly in the Midwest. So that's how we keep it current and try to keep it as good as we can. The last 2 years we've had one was the corn yield champion, and the second year we had the soybean champion, and I know yield champion, and I know now that person raised the record yield even higher. So it's more like 220 bushel soybeans per acre, which blows your mind. And we always make the point, Brian, I'm sure you would too, that we don't expect farmers to walk away from a presentation like that and grow 200 bushel soybeans. But if they get tips that can increase their yield by 10 or 20%, that makes it worthwhile.
Absolutely. So kind of transitioning to what you do, my curiosity now leads into you were effectively on the forefront of no-till in Ohio, working with the group you're working with, implementing that. What does that look like? What is a transition and the transformation of no-till practices in your region?
Well, Ohio is the home of the longest continuous no-till research, which started in 1962 at Worcester. And that no-till research, those plots have continued ever since. So we've got a great history there. Oh, probably in terms of the transitions, no-till became more common when John Deere introduced the 750 no-till drill and Roundup. Mm-hmm. So those couple of things really blossomed with people more interested in no-till. I think and somewhere around the year 2000 is when cover crops became more interesting and more involved, and most people realized that, yeah, no-till by itself, and we're talking here mainly corn-soybean rotation with some wheat once in a while, mm-hmm. that it could be a lot better if we added cover crops. And then we had a farmer who started using a cover crop mix, and now I think that's very common to have anywhere from 4 to 15 different varieties in a cover crop mix. And to get in that situation, in our case, we have to have wheat because that's the only way you have time for that for most of those cover crops to grow and do their job. In our case, after corn, the only cover crop that we really promote is cereal rye. If we're not harvesting corn until the middle or late November, cereal rye is the only one that has a chance to work.
So this is going to be a bit of a two-parter. So I'm going to start off with, especially in Ohio, no-till is not anything new. It's not anything new that's been presented by Ohio State in that extension program. So I guess my two-part question is, one, what limits or what slows the adoption of no-till in Ohio and the region? And then why should those who are not adopting really be much more interested in it?
Yeah, you raised an excellent point there. I just mentioned no-till's been around since the 1960s, and we're still only about 5% continuous no-till, and cover crops is about 5%. And you look at, and I don't have the answer to that. Ohio is no different, I think, than other Midwestern states in that I can talk all day about the why people ought to change, You've got costs, eroding soil, so it builds soil health to keep your soil instead of letting it go down the Mississippi River. And this is a good year to talk about costs because so many farmers are saying, man, we'll be lucky if we break even this year. And well, if you're into no-till, you can probably save $40 or $50 an acre once you get established in it. And from the soil health standpoint and the carbon sequestration standpoint, you can even get a little bit of bonus income with no-till and soil health, a few dollars an acre. The healthier soil, in other words, I think every farmer we know, Brian, has a goal of I want to leave the farm in better shape than when I started it. And healthier soil is a good way of establishing that. No-till and no-till cover crops and rotations is about the only way you can improve the value of soil.
So in my area, Randall, our biggest value by far for no-till is soil moisture conservation because we're in a constant moisture limited environment. Many of your areas, not necessarily moisture limited, but even may have moisture excess problems, especially in spring when it comes to planting time. So can you kind of discuss the difference of the regionality of no-till adoption, both the reasons and the challenges?
Well, an interesting right now, a good portion of Ohio and moving on east into West Virginia is suffering from a severe drought. It's not as bad as 1988, but still it is really hurting crops. Crops are maturing sooner, of course, lower yield with that. So we have drought conditions here in July and August fairly often. And you're right about having wet soil in the springtime. We're usually waiting until the soil dries out. In Oklahoma, you may be waiting until you get enough moisture in the soil to plant and hope the seeds germinate.
You're 100% right.
Yeah, and I'm going to quote Paul Yassa, that we both know from University of Nebraska. I'll just do this in shorthand. Long-term no-till, corn-soybean rotation without cover crops. That's one. Mm-hmm. Compared to corn-soybean rotation, and I think wheat with cover crop. He had a dry year, severely dry year. That must be 2022. And people looked at that growing cover crop and thought, oh my golly, it's going to suck all the moisture out of the soil. You won't have any moisture left for corn. So that next crop year, 2023, I should ask, all right, one of them got a lot more bushels per acre than the other. Which one of those situations do you think had the highest yield? And if I tell you it was 60 bushels per acre advantage to the one with that cover crop.
Yeah.
So it was, I think, 180 bushels compared to 120 bushel per acre. And Brian, the obvious question is, well, how could that possibly happen? Well, here's what the cover crop does. You lay it down. So through those hot months, you have the soil covered.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like putting a sheet of styrofoam over the soil. It keeps it cooler. Might be as much as 30 or 40 degrees difference on a hot summer afternoon. The other thing is, if it rains, say you get a 2-inch rainstorm in the middle of a drought with that cover crop, all of that rain stays right where it hits. It soaks in instead of running off and disappearing down the creek. So those are two advantages of how cover, even in a dry region. And I think we give credit to our own David Brandt, who died a little over a year ago, working with one of your outstanding farmers there in Oklahoma, Jimmy Emmons.
Jimmy Emmons, yep.
Convinced Jimmy to try cover crops, and it has worked for him.
No, in fact, that's some of the interesting things that we work through in Oklahoma when I'm trying to help a farmer with cover crops is always the first question for me is what's your target, what's your intention, is it a nutrient or water? Because most of our intention is water savings, which means we need a carbon heavy. We need to create that blanket that stays through the season. And so a lot of our cover crop that the mixtures don't work near as well, because we really need that carbon rye, heavy rye or wheat or something to protect for that evaporation, because we're trying to capture water and we're trying to keep water, and that's our bigger value.
So you've got those differences across the country, and that's where you have I'm glad you brought that up, because the cover crop mix that we might recommend here in Ohio or in upstate New York is certainly not going to be the same as what you're doing in Oklahoma or out in Oregon, for example.
Yep. So moving on to some of the other points along our conversation is, how does the NRCS and other programs, how does that play a factor in the adoption or implementation of these no-till and conservation practices?
NRCS programs certainly help by paying farmers to plant cover crops. One thing that we've found out is you get paid 3 years to plant cover crops. Then the money stops. And if the farmer hasn't seen any real advantage, they stop planting cover crops and go back to doing tillage. A couple of prominent people have said we need a 5-year program instead of three. The other point is that here in Ohio, the money's given directly to the farmer and the government, and I don't blame them necessarily for this. They say, 100% of the money goes to the farmer. It all goes to the farmer. We would make the point, let's keep back 10% of that for education. Or require, if you're going to get a few thousand dollars to plant cover crops, you need the education on it. So we would require, if you're going to get money, come to one of our field days or educational conferences and spend a couple of days maybe learning about cover crops so you know how to manage it. And if you know how to manage it, even 3 years, you're going to see the advantage of it. I've got to throw in, and you probably have the same situation in Oklahoma. Across the Midwest, about half of the land is farmed by a tenant farmer. They don't own the land. So, again, it's easy for us to talk about, you're building soil health, you're building soil quality. But if the person doing the farming is at risk of not having that farm next year, and that happens, we've got really good no-tillers who have farmed land for 10 or 15 years, and all of a sudden, maybe because of a death and somebody in the younger generation takes over. I know one specific example where the lady just demanded that the ground be plowed. And the farmer who was doing it said, I don't even own a plow. I can't plow it. So, and here's what will likely happen in that situation. And it's not level. It's not flat land. It's land that ought to be no-till in this example. That after the guy that plows it, he'll probably get outstanding yields that first year.
Absolutely.
Filled up with no-till. And then maybe the second year, the yields will go down a little bit. And maybe after a third year, the farmer will say, hey, I can't afford this. This is ridiculous. So then that same lady will go back to the long-term no-till farmer and say, we'd like for you to come back. And I know what that farmer would like to do. He'd probably be too kind. But then you're literally starting over. And that's one thing about changing, getting farmers to change. And you and I know anybody to change anything is a challenge. But getting conventional till farmers to adopt no-till, continuous no-till, and all these practices we're talking about here, it's really a challenge to get them to even think about changing. And there is more management involved, so it's a different system.
It's a mindset change too, right? I mean, it's a complete change of the approach of management styles, of equipment needs, our needs. And almost to me, a little bit of a flexibility with the tillage system. You can be a little bit more cut and dry, but once you go into no-till, you almost force a little bit of a need to have flexibility in your plans.
And another thing about the soil, think about somebody that's driven Ford pickup trucks all the time. They always have a Ford pickup truck. They decide to go to Chevrolet. Well, that's maybe it takes a month to get accustomed to everything being a little bit different on a Chevrolet pickup, but it's a short term. With soil, if it's been tilled for years and you switch to no-till, it takes years. That soil's been degraded. You can't expect it to recover and become great in a month. So you've got to have the dedication to a few years of building it up, investing more than you might like to in those first 3 years.
Which does go back to, for our region, I believe the number is most farmers only own 40% of the ground they manage. No. And so it's 60% leased.
Right.
And we're talking about something, as you say, in some conditions may take a fair amount of input to get over that hump of what 80 to 120 years of tillage has done. And if I've only got a three-year lease agreement with no promise that that's going to go beyond that point, it's really hard to convince somebody to put those inputs on a piece of ground that you may not ever see the benefit.
And it takes some salesmanship to do that persuasion and maybe see, well, can we get a five-year or a 10-year lease and have some kind of agreement at the end if it is a shorter term? I know, and this is a different example, but putting in tile drainage in Ohio is very common. Our best land, if it's not tile drained, you just don't get good yields. So obviously that's another big investment. And in a similar way, if you're investing cover crops, if you're investing, putting more lime on, just working with the tenant. And that brings up another topic. And in so many cases, being blunt about it, the landlord is actually a landlady. In other words, quite often it's a widow who is still there. And we are trying to educate these widows, and the same thing would be applied to the second generation down, where maybe three kids and they all live in the big city somewhere, and all they're interested in is getting income off of that 2,000 acre farm. To educate them about soil health and the value of doing things correctly, the way you and I would describe it, Brian. So there's some education there also.
Yeah, we had a big push probably about 10 or 12 years ago when we were really trying to push no-till. And the 2 points that we went to wasn't the farmer. It was the absentee landowners or landlords, often widows, and banks, financial units. Because of small town bankers, because farmers had to go in and look at, okay, I need to invest in a no-till drill. I need to invest in the equipment to manage no-till because all I own is a plow, a disc, and a chisel and a field cultivator. And so there was a significant effort put on both financial units and the landlords. And over time, we have seen a shift in how many of the leases are written. Part of that, I don't think our education did it, but the change in social awareness about farming has kind of infiltrated across the world. So there seems to be a little more interest from the absentee landlords on how the fields are managed now than we did, I'd say, 15, 20 years ago. And we did, I think, made a lot of good inroads with the financial institutions that were, not every farmer can go out and lay down cash for the equipment needed to convert. And so that operating loan is a big part of agriculture.
Yeah, that's an excellent point about, I'm glad you mentioned the banks. We need to do more with the bankers. And in a somewhat the same way, convincing a banker that my yields may go down for a year or two. I may need a little bit more. Well, we definitely on corn, you would need more nitrogen that first year or two. But then after you get into it, it's really going to pay off with less cost. So that's, convincing somebody other than the person doing the farming is a challenge.
So I got one last question before we wrap this up on topic. It's one that you have in your list of things is that you said that carbon sequestration is a commonly used term to describe how soil can hold carbon. But is there a better term than sequestration we should be considering?
Well, I've been told by, especially Don Rakoski, who's a soil scientist, retired from ARS in Minnesota, I'm an engineer, so I don't know all these soil things. But here's the point, and here's the example. Sequestration implies that you're putting something into a vault deep and you're never going to touch it. In reality, the carbon and what we're talking about here is taking carbon out of the air, carbon dioxide, putting it into the soil as organic matter. And instead of sequestering it, it's more like a storage, temporary storage. So I've come up with the example. Think of it as your refrigerator. You put food into the refrigerator, and then you take food out. And the carbon is there to provide food for the enzymes and all the life in the soil that we often ignore, so that it can survive. So it's in and out.
Mm-hmm. And yes.
To use a refrigerator example, that as the years go by, you need a bigger refrigerator because you're storing more carbon. And therefore, it's more like storage would be a better term than sequestration.
And I like the refrigerator additive because of exactly as you said, the microbial community and that it's in and out and then the breakdown. You know, as we increase microbial activity, we increase carbon consumption by the microbes. And so our systems flux with weather, with climate, both short-term, long-term. And so we need that storage device to grow and grow and grow because there's going to be cycles that we draw down on the carbon and cycles that we increase the carbon more so than the average rate. And so I love the concept of the refrigerator, the carbon refrigerator. That makes a lot of sense to me.
And from the standpoint of storing organic matter, storing carbon as organic matter in the soil, so many of these programs that come out now that are going to pay $25 an acre, they only want farmers who are going to transition to no-till. They don't want the been in there 10 years, and that just raises Cain with the ones who have been doing and say, hey, I'm doing it right. Why don't you pay me? And what the funders or whoever's making those decisions in Washington, D.C. don't understand is that, a lot of organic matter might be in the top 6 inches of the soil. But if you're long-term no-till, earthworms and deep roots, that organic matter continues to go down. Beginning no-till or if somebody's been in a few years might have a lot of organic matter in the top 6 inches, and I'm just picking a number. Whereas somebody's been doing it a long time, it'd be more like 16 inches or 24 inches deep. Mm-hmm. A lot of carbon down there. So the point being that even if you've got soil that's high organic matter in the surface inches, that soil can continue to store more carbon and benefit the environment. And if you're I've used this phrase for years, Brian, on climate change. I don't care what your vision is, which political slant, whether you are in favor of climate change, we need to do everything we can to slow down climate change, or if you say it's all a bunch of bunk and forget about it. Regardless, when you take carbon out of the air and store it in the soil, increasing your organic matter, that is a benefit to you. It's a benefit to your farmland. So do it. Don't worry about whether it's helping the...
whether it's trendy or not.
Right. Yes.
Agreed.
It's time for our famous three.
Explore the future of agriculture with KWS, a global leader in innovation and sustainable farming practices. Uncover the exceptional qualities of our hybrid rye, cultivating a legacy for a greener tomorrow. Visit kws.com/US for more information and for dealer locations. KWS, seeding the future since 1856.
Well, I hate to say it, but we're coming up on my time bump here, so I'm going to wrap up. Randall, where do you go for resources? Where are the places you look to for information, whether it be no-till or just every day?
Well, most people know about the National No-Till Conference and the Lessiter Media, started by Frank Lessiter back in 1972. I think I get more, I get really good information from that conference and also from the monthly magazine that they publish, No-Till Farmer. This will sound self-serving. I've been writing a column now for that for the last 5 or 6 months. Sometimes I have trouble coming up with a new topic for the column. But anyway, seriously, the farmers that go to that National No-Till Conference and the experts, university people, ARS folks, for example, that they bring in, they really provide excellent information. So that's one source of information. And from research, from our own research at Ohio State University, that's another source. So that pretty well helps you out there, Brian.
All right. Now, the next question that I've been looking forward to asking you specifically is, you know, what do you do in your free time?
Well, you're in Oklahoma.
I am.
A lot of my free time involves a person that's pretty well known out there named Will Rogers. About 25, 26 years ago, I started giving talks as Will Rogers because a prominent speaker, he was actually an ag economist from Woodward, told me, "Hey, you look like Will Rogers. You gotta do Will Rogers talk." So I've been doing it ever since. And I spend a lot of time writing. I write a weekly comments in his style. I just attended a conference where veteran speakers, that were speakers who have been around a long time, professional speakers, and they recognize four legends every year plus one posthumous. And this year they decided to recognize Will Rogers as their posthumous legend. Well, I had a lot of fun with it because I thought it was posthumous award, but but back to it's really fun kind of being in the being Will Rogers and learning. I've learned so much about him and how fantastic he is, how fantastic he was and is for the state of Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. It's just fun doing it. I've got a website on that one, willrogerstoday.com.
Will Rogers Today. Well, what are some of the other websites that go along with your work, specifically the Conservation Tillage Technology Conference?
Yeah, coming back to the reason we're actually talking here today, that one is a very simple website. It's ctc.osu, that's meaning our Ohio State University. So ctc.osu.edu. And we've got information on that website. It's actually hosted within the Department of Food, Ag, and Biological Engineering at Ohio State. We're not exactly current on it, but we usually post all of the presentations from the conferences, and many of them are on there. The other website is, I'm involved with the Ohio No-Till Council, so that website is ohionotillcouncil.com, and there's no hyphen between no and till in that one. So we list information about programs that we're going to do and ones that we have done.
Fantastic. Well, folks, that wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guest, Randall Reeder, who is the program coordinator of the annual Conservation Tillage and Technology Conference and also the executive director of the Ohio No-Till Council. Y'all, if you enjoyed this conversation, hit that subscribe button and make sure you receive notifications for every time a new podcast drops. Make sure you share this video with your friends or colleagues that you think would enjoy the conversation we had again. And of course, leave us a comment if you have any questions for our guest or suggestions to who we should have on next time. Randall, thank you so much for joining us today. I've had an absolute pleasure, sir.
Fun for me, too. And always glad to do anything involving Oklahoma.
There we go.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.